Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Stelios.
Hello.
And I'm Josh. And we're going to be talking about today how to think better. And this has come from the finding that there's a whole assortment of psychological studies that have suggested that the human brain is basically replete with all of these cognitive biases. But how can we overcome these biases? As well as that, there's also research that is shown that the environment that we make our decisions in actually changes the ultimate decision we can make, in that if we're put in two different surroundings or emotional states or anything of that nature, it could change how we decide. So that obviously raises the question, well, what situation is most desirable to come to the best decision? Yeah. And we'll be answering that as well. And that is what we're trying to do. And of course, all of these biases are sort of unconscious, because of course, unconscious bias is a real thing, although it has been used to basically have this irrefutable boogeyman in the form of unconscious bias training, which says that all of us are unconsciously racist. But of course, the actual reality of that training is that, well, even if you are racist, there's no necessary link between actual real world behavior and that attitude in the first place. Okay. But that's a bit of a tangent, because this is all sort of seriously demonstrable stuff. And the main means of us overcoming many of these biases is through what is known as metacognition. And you might be able to deduce what that is, but just so we're all on the same page, I'm going to quote directly here. It refers to the process involving monitoring, controlling, and regulating one's own cognitive processes, including attention, memory, problem solving, and it involves awareness and an understanding of one's own thought processes, as well as the ability to reflect on and evaluate one's own cognitive performance. Basically, it's thinking about one's own thinking, which is relatively simple. I mean, most people should do that and do it regularly. And we're going to go through and make what quite often is not necessarily a conscious and deliberate act more conscious and deliberate, because that has been shown to improve the quality of it.
I think that a good way to understand metacognition is to point towards the distinction between the object of thinking and the act of thinking. Mm-hmm. And very frequently we say that thought has intentionality, that thought is about something. I can think about what I'm going to have for dinner, for instance. Like I think where I want to go for a vacation. This is called the object of thinking, or we could say it's the object that we think about. Metacognition has to do with thought becoming its own object. And that is why, for instance, we focus more on the faculties and their reliability, instead of just focusing on what it is that we're thinking in the other sense. Mm-hmm. So I think that this is a good way of thinking about it.
I would like to think so. Yeah. I've certainly thought a lot about it. Yeah. I'm going to stop making self-referential puns now and actually get onto this. So I mentioned at the start that differing mental states can change the outcomes of your decisions. And I've actually done some proper research into this. And one theory I want to draw attention to is one that I have mentioned before, but I'm going to go into greater detail here and do a very self-indulgent thing and quote my own research paper and read it out. But
well,
I will also
translate
it.
If you don't believe in it, why would anyone else?
That's very true, yes. Yeah. But constural level theory is basically a way of describing what could be described as common sense, although in much greater detail than you would ordinarily think about it in practical terms. And of course, it is, of course, supported by research. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about it in the first place. But I'm going to define it now just by reading out what I wrote about it in my own words, and then translating it from academic English into regular English. So the theory proposes that our external environment is represented in abstract mental depictions. Okay, that's not that hard to understand. I'm going to go through and break each line down tediously, but yes, everyone will be on the same page. So yes, we create mental depictions of the world around us. These abstract mental depictions are based upon past and current experiences, which provide a basis to estimate future decisions that concern either ourselves or perhaps another. These mental representations are known as construals. The purpose of forming these construals is that it provides a means of transcending your current state, forming a representation of a more psychologically distant state. So that's trying to imagine hypothetical situations, basically. It's using your own personal experiences, things that have actually transpired, to imagine things that might transpire. Psychological distance can be defined as a scale of subjective relation of the external to the self. The distance aspect is metaphysical, referring to things like space, time, and experience, be it real or imagined experience. So you could use the example of our own experiences being considered less psychologically distant than our own imagined experiences of others. So the distance we have to...
To navigate
is higher for things that we haven't experienced or we're imagining what they would be like than things we have experienced. That's not really... much of a shock here so far.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't think that it should be, because very frequently when we think, for instance, of our mental faculties, if we really look at, for instance, imagination, we will see that instead of coming up with something completely new, we are taking things that we have already experienced and put them together.
Exactly.
So the only thing we have is our own experiences, and we can only build upon them.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that definitely is suboptimal from an idealistic perspective, but it's the only thing we have.
Exactly. And I'm not necessarily decrying this as a bad thing per se, but there are some quirks of it that I think need mitigating, which I'll get onto later.
Yeah.
And it carries on to say, an increase in psychological distance corresponds to the level of abstraction of the mental construal. The greater the distance, the greater the level of abstraction. So the further from your own experience you get, the more abstract it becomes, which is unsurprising, really.
One question, is it more abstract or is it a bit more general in the sense that in order to bridge that gap, you need to assume that what you have already experienced will be like that in everything else?
Well, that's just, you could use either term to describe it, in that a more general thing is more abstract from reality, because reality is very particular, because you make a generalization because it's an abstract.
Okay.
So I'm being very pedantic, but...
No, I mean, I'm all for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know it.
And the final line of that paragraph, before I get onto the latter one, is, therefore, differing construal levels result in different ways of thinking. So the sort of levels of abstraction from your own frame of reference, from your own experience, that you go outwards... towards, the more you go away from your own personal experience, the more abstract it gets, and therefore there is a difference between something that you've got direct experience of and something that you've got a distant imagined experience of. There shouldn't be too much of a stretch here, because this is, of course, common sense, but described in painstaking detail, which is a lot of the work that psychology seems to do these days.
Yeah.
But it's important, because there are things that aren't so common sense. So research has shown that pragmatic thinking is more salient at lower construal levels, and idealistic thinking is more salient at higher construal levels. So to go back to what we were talking about, when we're thinking grounded in our own experiences entirely, we're more pragmatic, meaning we think more practically about the steps we can take about a potential goal. We're thinking more in terms of the realities of a situation. It's more current and a bit more short term, although it's still talking about, you know, periods of time in the matter of days, weeks, months, maybe even years. However, idealistic thinking, it tends to be more about the end goal and the desirability of that end goal rather than how to get there. And a lot of the time, that might be nice, but how many times have you had a thought about something? Say you wanted something, and then when you actually got it, you were kind of a bit disappointed. I find this a lot with food.
Yeah,
I mean, I crave something to eat, And then by the time I get it, I was just like, well, actually, that was a bit more underwhelming than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it frequently happens.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we have this idealized view of something in our heads, even though it might be something we have experience of, but clearly not enough to know ourselves well enough to know our reaction in the future.
Yeah,
I was just going to say, we have this idealized view about something, but it's not quite as useful. And this is why I'm always a big advocate of experience, because experience changes the way you think about things, and experiencing lots of new things therefore gives you better perspective and stops you having to have these more idealistic, distant experiences that might be different to the actual realities of the situation.
I think that this is more metacognition that does this. Personally, mm-hmm. Again, I'm being pedantic, because it seems to me that idealization comes from experience, and it comes from the habit of expecting things. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you said that you expected to have a meal and say, wow, what an excellent meal. This seems to me to be an outcome of habit, because you may have eaten mm-hmm. a particular dish and say that this is an excellent dish mm-hmm. many times, and expect every other time mm-hmm. for that meal to be excellent.
Well, because the self is still the frame of reference for even the yeah. most abstract thinking, it still relates to your experience in some way, okay. no matter how abstract you get. But it's a sort of scale, isn't it? From, you know, something that you've done your entire life.
Let's say a particular hobby.
Yeah, all right. So I've been playing guitar for years. So say, on the one hand, there's me playing guitar. I know it in and out. I could probably do it in my sleep almost.
Yeah.
And then something I've never done before. I don't know.
Piano.
Skydiving. I played piano already.
Pick
another that
one.
First. Yeah, skydiving. Let's do that. I'm never going to do that. And I can't possibly begin to imagine what it would be like. But chances are that my thoughts and behaviours around playing guitar, which I've got lots of conscious experience of, and my thoughts and behaviours around skydiving, I think I'm going to have a more accurate, objective view of the former rather than the latter, right?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. So, carrying on, idealism is associated with higher constral levels, as constral levels appear to elicit greater consideration to the possibility of positive outcomes and less consideration of negative outcomes. It's also worth mentioning as well that, you know, when you're thinking about something abstractly and being idealistic about it, which seems to be the case, the further we move away from our own experience, then we tend to be more positive and idealistic about it than negative. This is, of course, this can go the other way as well. This is only a general rule. We can think about something that's so far removed from ourselves as being a lot worse.
Would you say that in idealism we are obstructing so many of the features of normal life mm-hmm. and we neglect the consequences? And for the most part, we just think of the symbol, what is ideal?
Well, it's almost like an ends focus in and of itself. It's thinking about, it brings forth lots of emotions about the end, but it doesn't necessarily tell us how we're going to get there in
it's
a step-by-step
like
basis.
Daydreaming
or the limitations, in a sense, okay. I suppose, not always. Where was I?
Sorry, I derailed the
that's
conversation.
All right. Whereas the opposite is true of lower constral levels, in which more pragmatic thinking is salient. Pragmatic thinking leads individuals to make decisions that more accurately consider potential obstacles that are a consequence of their decisions, and therefore providing greater consideration of the negative consequences of their decision. So the way in which you think about something and the amount of experience you have changes the thought processes that are involved in thinking about it in the first place.
Okay.
So you're going to be more practical, basically, which I think practicality is good. I think having practical steps...
I would say so.
Controversial, yeah. I know. But yes, having real-world steps and having real knowledge of the nature of something and what you have to overcome is far more beneficial than just saying, oh, here's the ideal ends that I want to move towards. Because you hear it all the time of people who really wanted to be famous, say, and they actually become famous and they hate it.
Yes.
And that's because they didn't think about the actual reality of the situation. They had this ideal in their head of what it might be like. But because they didn't have enough experience to ground that in reality, then it led them to pursuing a misguided goal. And that's kind of the point of me bringing this up in the first place, is that many of the things that we hold to be desirable ideals, more often than not, if we actually achieved them, we would have a very different reaction than we might expect.
I think that shows brilliantly how fragmented our thinking frequently is, mm-hmm. and why most philosophers, let's say across time, have urged human beings to think things in a more holistic way and just have in mind people who daydream and they say, for instance, oh, I want to spend my whole life on a beach just drinking margaritas. Mm-hmm. And then if you may go there and after 2 hours you get bored and you go back to your city mm-hmm. or to your place of origin.
I think holidays are another good example, because yes. I remember I was very excited to go to Venice once. I thought, oh, wow, this is such a significant cultural capital in a way. Not necessarily a capital city, of course, but a cultural capital in that it holds a lot of import. I'm looking forward to seeing all the amazing architecture, going on a gondola, seeing all the art, having authentic Italian food. But when I actually got there, the reality and the ideal did not match up. I mean, all of the water that was surrounding us smelt bad because it was the middle of August. It stunk, most of it. It smelt like rotten eggs, pretty much all of Venice. Yeah. The food was ridiculously overpriced. We spent like 10 euros on a basket of bread before our food even arrived. And they didn't tell us that we had to pay for it. We just thought it was complimentary. There were tourists everywhere. It was a boiling hot day. It was like 36 degrees and you had to pay €2.50 to go to the toilet. So I spent like... nearly 10 euros just going to the toilet. So the whole experience was just like, wow, I'm in a massive tourist trap. I expected it to be a lot different to this. And I actually found that a lot of the other places that were less culturally significant, but quieter and nicer and less touristy, were far better than my experience there. I mean, it's nice to say that I've been there.
I mean, you couldn't have predicted that in advance.
No. But I could have been more realistic with my expectations.
Tourists going to Venice protesting about tourists being there.
Well, I like to pretend that I'm above it. I'm not your typical tourist, you see. Yeah. I try and integrate with their culture, so I don't, I see it as good manners. I mean, I can't be here talking about how immigrants to this country should integrate and then go abroad and say, I'll have fish and chips, please.
Yeah.
it just doesn't work. And... yes, I think that the point being here is that we like to think of our judgment about the world to be this perfect thing, but actually the amount of experience we have towards something shapes how we think about it. And it's just important to bear in mind that sometimes when we think about something that we don't have experience of, we don't have any frame of reference to ground it in reality, and therefore we can be misguided. And so keeping that in mind when you think about things, and actually having a bit of humility in approaching people who do have expertise in this area that you're curious about, that's very, very useful. Another example could be, I wanted to go on after I finished my master's degree, become an academic, a university lecturer. And every university lecturer I spoke to said, oh yeah, that's all well and good, but the actual reality of it is it's pretty terrible and you shouldn't do it and get a job in the private sector. You'll be happier. And that was like multiple of them. And after a while, I was just like, well, okay, I see where this is going.
I know, but I've experienced the same thing. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think that, I mean, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try or that you should always take what experts say as mm-hmm. a given.
Well, of course.
Because you have to bear in mind that these people, they constantly talk about competition and they may look at you as future competition. So especially in academia, there are people trying to dishearten others. So
I don't think I was necessarily disheartened, because they did cite like, well, you might have this ideal of, your time split between researching and, teaching, but actuality it's spent doing lots of paperwork and tedious stuff, and it's not quite as glamorous. It was basically what they're trying to say. And I mean, I didn't think it was that glamorous in the first place. I just thought, well, I'll be good at this. Maybe I should give it a go.
Yeah.
But they pointed out to me that, yeah, actually, there's a lot more to it than what I had conceived of. And I obviously did lots of research about it and what it entailed, the salary, job responsibilities, requirements, yeah. how competitive it was. So I did all of that stuff. But the actual day-to-day reality of the job
was different
to what I believed.
I like the word humility you used, because it seems to me that the beginning of the journey mm-hmm. for thinking better comes with humility, with
Absolutely,
epistemic
yeah.
humility, as it is said.
We will be talking about that.
And with a recognition that we are not infallible.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be, that human fallibility is going to be a running theme throughout all of this. And I think it's a very healthy thing.
What is this concept?
What is human fallibility?
Yeah, what is it? I don't know.
Well, I know you're being tongue-in-cheek, but yeah. it's basically the notion that human judgment is imperfect and...
We can make mistakes.
The thing about imperfection, particularly in our thinking, is that we can never truly know when it's happening to us, because if we are aware that we're thinking in an imperfect way, we would adjust for it. So it's always worth bearing in mind that we could be thinking in a way that's unhelpful to us, because it's always beyond our awareness, because we wouldn't be doing it in the first place if we were. So yeah. approaching every decision you make, all your thoughts, with a certain amount of skepticism about the truth of it is healthy. And I think that more people should do it, because very few people seem to in this day and age, don't they?
Yeah. But there's a question whether doubt sometimes can be extreme, and whether in mm-hmm. some cases a more, let's say, robust affirmation or a strong affirmation of some views are better.
Well, I do think
that with the overwhelming majority of human judgments, we need to be, let's say, aware of our fallibility, and we need to have a sort of doubt.
Let doubt prevail, one could say.
Yes, but in some cases, I think that doubt is a bit unhealthy.
It can be extreme. What cases are those?
Well, if, for instance, you have people denying, if you have people who are diffident with affirming laws of logic, mm-hmm. and by implication, people who are diffident with respect to dismissing claims that other people make. This mm-hmm. frequently comes with the other fallacy of appealing to authority, because some, for instance, people are so diffident. They are the exact opposite of the arrogant person who thinks, no, I know everything. Mm-hmm. They go to the other extreme. And they say that, I don't know, I don't feel the confidence to assert anything. So you have people who may utter complete nonsense, but they do it in a particular way that they appear as if they know what they're saying. And then you have others falling for it.
Mm-hmm. I think that the healthiest approach to this is, obviously, there's an objective reality, and that reality exists outside of our observations. It's not yeah. all subjective. It's not all your opinion, man. It's just a matter of knowing how much weight to give something. Like yeah. you could, using, say, a law of gravity,
yeah.
for example. Obviously, we know if we drop something, it falls to the ground. I don't think there have been many experiments, at least on Earth, whereby this doesn't happen. So to deny that gravity exists is taking doubt too far. But you could say that our current understanding of gravity is not as detailed as it could be, and then you might be making a fair judgment. And I think having a hierarchy of how much weight you should give things
yes.
is the healthiest approach, but it never reaches 100. You're either... Yes. You're somewhere between 1 and 100 in terms of absolute doubt and absolute certainty.
Yeah.
And it's just a matter of finding out about how much this specific thing deserves to be scored, I suppose okay. you could say. Another thing, as well, is the level of abstraction from your own experience that can shape how you think about something and might lead you to make a different decision than you might otherwise, is, of course, emotion. And I think we've all experienced this, how emotions can override rational thinking. And I've included this because it shouldn't be news to anyone. Everyone knows about this, don't they?
I frequently have road rage.
Really?
Yeah.
I get road anxiety. I hate driving. I'm normally fearful of everyone.
I love it, but everyone else is driving from the wrong lane.
What, you driving on the right-hand side of the road? Are you like an American?
They're driving the wrong... No, not here. I mean, everywhere. You know?
Oh, right.
No, I'm joking. It's just that I frequently get road rage with people, and I would like to think that it doesn't cloud my judgment, but I feel that I have to say that it does.
I get irrationally angry at all sorts of things, but normally they're inconsequential. Like, I get... Big things don't annoy me.
Yeah.
Like things that are sort of an existential weight to society. It's the petty things that annoy me. Like, oh, that person's, look at them. They've gone outside wearing their blimmin' pyjamas. Who do they think they are, eroding the standards?
I must say this, sorry. I hate when people on the train, they have loud music without headphones. Mm-hmm. Sorry, this is not good behavior.
But it clouds your judgment. What, the emotional outrage makes you feel like it's more of an indiscretion than it otherwise would be.
I felt it yesterday. I was furious. Furious.
To be fair, I'd be angry as well. Yeah. I'd say that's not even that unreasonable. But things like fear and anger lead individuals to be more impulsive in their decision-making and might lead you to make decisions that you may regret upon reflection. Particularly in arguments with loved ones, I think that this is something that comes into play, whereby you get angry for a moment, you get it out of your system by, you know, shouting at them maybe, or just being rude. And then later on you think, wow, I really let my emotions get the better of me. I feel pretty bad about that. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
And I'm sure everyone's done that, haven't they? I know I certainly have plenty of times. And obviously it would have been better to come to a conclusion when you weren't so emotionally charged, because
of course
this is self-evident, but I'm just kind of belaboring the point that you're not always thinking in a way that is helpful to you. And it's about you trying to identify these factors and controlling for them. And your experience and your emotions are two of the most important things to consider in the rest of this conversation.
Yeah.
And obviously this isn't some sort of revelation, but still it goes to make the point that this is still a difficult thing.
Yes.
I mean, I've been aware of this for a very long time. I still fall afoul of these things, but less so than I used to, because I have employed strategies that help mitigate these problems.
I think that if we pay close attention at what is going on, if we introspect somehow, or we try to think of, let's say, our lives in our situation at the moment, there are so many things going on simultaneously, and we sort of need to have a sort of autopilot.
Mm.
And that is why I think we frequently do this, and we do it again and again and again.
What's going on there is the unconscious deals with large amounts of information very well, because it's got quick sort of rule-based processes that pick out the important information and work with it without having to be too effortful.
Okay.
Effortful, even. Can't speak for some reason. But sometimes you've got to be able to identify a situation and say, actually, no, I'm going to take this off your hands, unconscious mind. I'm going to deal with this one myself. Yeah. And you consciously deliberate.
I'm calling the shots.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use the example that I use all the time with the dichotomy of the conscious mind and the unconscious mind, is that your consciousness is like, you know, a jockey riding a horse. The horse is ultimately the thing moving. It's the thing in control. It's the thing that directs roughly where you're going. But the jockey can influence how quickly it gets there and which direction it's going in. And so make no mistakes, the horse is ultimately in control. But you can also train it to respond to the jockey better.
Yeah.
So analogies aside, going back to what I was talking about, some studies have also shown that people in positive emotional states, such as excitement or euphoria, are more likely to take risks and make bold decisions as well. So even if you're angry or fearful or euphoric and excited, neither of these are particularly desirable to make a decision. And I think a lot of the time, most people have the sort of reflectiveness about them to know better than make decisions when they have these sort of extreme emotions.
Would you say that this shows a kind of conservative temperament of the human psyche, in that when we experience some emotions, we want to perpetuate them? So for instance, if you have extreme emotions, there is a tendency that we have either positive or negative extreme emotions. There's a tendency to get into loops and try to replay them.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily a deliberate thing, but...
No, I'm not saying it is, but it does
happen. There's a sort of self-reinforcing mechanism in that neural pathways that are well-traveled quite often remain so because they're almost the path of least resistance for cognition.
Tell me if this is a tangent, but I have a question about this, and I want your psychologist's answer, your answer from a psychological perspective. I've met some people who they say they're bored easily, and they constantly need a sort of, let's say, adrenaline fix. I don't know how but they constantly say that they're bored easily. How do you explain that from a psychological perspective? Or is it unrelated and I misunderstood?
No, that's still relevant. I think to quote my own grandmother, only boring people get bored. Yeah. And if you can't occupy yourself with your own thoughts, in that I've always held this view of the human mind that if I was sat in an empty room, it's completely white, and I wasn't bored, I've achieved something good with my psychology. In that if I can keep myself entertained without any external stimuli, just thinking about the world, thinking about things, entertaining myself in my own head, that is clearly the more desirable thing than needing constant external stimulation. I think the need for constant externalities portrays some sort of poverty within, doesn't it?
Yes.
People who are always busy, always trying to do the next best thing.
Yeah.
I think that they're struggling with their own emotions in a sense, or reflecting on them. They're doing it to almost give themselves a dopamine hit. It's almost like a sort of
prevention of thinking about their own lack of imagination.
Well, maybe. Yeah. It could be a whole host of things. It could be negative emotions that are unresolved.
Okay, yeah.
All sorts of things. But then, of course, you could just be wanting to have fun. I mean, I don't want to pathologize everyone like that.
Yeah, I just had in mind some people who constantly, I find them boring, basically.
I find that people who find...
They have constant need of external stimulation, constant need of change of scenery.
I think people who can't relax and take life easy and enjoy the simple pleasures, they have something about themselves that they need to work out and resolve, because I think that should be something common in all people. And it's not necessarily the worst thing to have. At least you will be productive, I suppose. You'll be doing lots of stuff.
Yep.
It's better than being inactive and not caring. But at the same time, it is its own problem in a sense.
Yep.
So the final thing about emotion before I move on to decision making is that negative emotions can lead people to being too cautious as well. And you can use the example of being anxious about whether someone will like you will lead them to be more negative about you in the first place as well, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it's better not to care at all, in a sense, obviously, or not to put too much weight on caring.
This
not caring at all is bad.
Why many men have problem with women. There's so much, they have this on their mind so much that they need the approval of that, of a particular woman. And it makes them feel a bit anxious, and they betray anxiety.
And a lot of the time, this is something that it's a sort of monster created in your own head, in that, well, the optimal strategy is, even if you do care, not to care. And I mean, I'm not saying fake it till you make it. I don't actually believe in that. I think actually being genuine and getting more negative feedback is actually a good thing. But yeah, just take a step back, take a breath, know how to control your emotions, and don't take it too seriously.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.